two people can hope to survive while sharing the same amount of oxygen. But I will, very shortly. He removed a stopwatch from his pocket, waved his swagger stick, and the soldiers hurled first Hannah and then Scott into the safe. The smile remained on the general's face as two of the soldiers pushed the massive door closed. The lights all began flashing red. The general clicked his stopwatch. When the car came to a halt, Kratz reckoned that the distance they had traveled was under a mile. He heard the door open and felt a shove on his arm to indicate he should get out of the car. He was pushed up three stone steps before entering a building and walking into a long corridor. His footsteps echoed on the wooden floor. Then he was guided into a room on his left where he was pushed down onto a chair, tied, and gagged. His shoes and socks were removed. When he heard the door close, he sensed he was alone. It was a long time. He couldn't be sure just how long before the door opened again. The first voice he heard was General Hamil's. "Remove the gag," was all he said. Kratz could hear him pacing around the chair, but at first the general said nothing. Kratz began to concentrate. He knew the pill was good for 2 hours, no more, and he suspected it was already 40 or 50 minutes since they had driven him away from Bath headquarters.
"Colonel Kratz, I have waited some time for the privilege of making your acquaintance. I've long admired your work. You are a perfectionist."
"Cut the crap," said Kratz, "because I don't admire you or your work." He waited for the first slap of gloves across his face or for a fist to come crashing into his jaw, but the general simply continued to circle the chair.
"You mustn't be too disappointed," said the general. "I feel sure, after all you've heard about us, that you must have expected at least some electric shocks by now. Perhaps the Chinese water torture, even the rack. But I fear, unlike Mossad, Colonel, that when dealing with people of your seniority, we long ago dispensed with such primitive methods. We have found them to be outmoded, a thing of the past. Worse, they just don't get results. You Zionists are tough and well-trained. Few of you talk, very few. So we've had to resort to more scientific methods to gain the information we need."
If it was still within the hour, thought Kratz, he'd judged it well.
"A simple injection of PPX will ensure that we learn everything we want to know," continued the general. "And once we have the information we require, we'll simply kill you. So much more efficient than in the past, and with all the environmental complaints one gets nowadays, so much more tidy. Though I must confess I miss the old methods, so you'll appreciate why I couldn't resist locking Miss Kopeck and Professor Bradley in their safe, especially since they hadn't seen each other for so long."
Kratz's hand was pressed back and held against the arm of the chair. He felt fingers searching for a vein, and when the needle went in, he flinched. He began counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. He was about to find out if one of Europe's leading chemists had, as she claimed, found the antidote for the Iraqis' latest truth drug. Mossad had tracked down the supplier in Austria. Strange how many think there are no Jews left in Austria.
37, 38, 39.
The drug was still in its testing stage and needed to be proved under non-laboratory conditions. If a person could remain fully in control of his senses while appearing to be under hypnosis, then they would know their antidote was a success.
1 minute. 1 minute one. 1 minute two. 1 minute three.
The test would come when they stuck the second needle in, and that might be anywhere. Then the trick was to show no reaction whatsoever, or the general would immediately realize that the original injection had failed to have the required effect. The training program for this particular realistic experience was not universally popular among agents. And although Kratz had experienced the prick, as it was affectionately known, once a month for the past 9 months, you only had a single chance in non-laboratory conditions to discover if you could pass the test. 1:37. 1:38. 1:39. The injection was meant to take effect after 2 minutes, and every agent had been taught to expect the second needle at some time between 2 and 3 minutes, thus the counting. 1:56. 1:57. Relax. It must come at any moment. Relax. Suddenly the needle was jabbed in and out of the big toe on his left foot. Kratz stopped gritting his teeth. Even his breathing remained regular. He had won the Israeli Pincushion Award, first class. Mossad made jokes about everything. Chapter 32.
And all that time, I really thought you were dead.
We had no way of letting you know, said Scott.
Still, it's no longer of any importance, Simon, said Hannah. Sorry. Scott will take a bit of getting used to. I may not be able to manage it in the time we've got left.
We may have more time left than you realize, said Scott.
How can you say that?
One of the contingency plans that Kratz and I worked on was that if any of us were caught and tortured while someone else was still free, we'd hold out for 1 hour before telling them the whopper. Hannah knew exactly what Mossad meant by the whopper, even if on this occasion she didn't know the details. Although I have to admit, this is one scenario we never considered, said Scott. In fact, the exact opposite. We thought that if we were able to convince them we had another purpose for bringing the safe to Baghdad, they'd immediately evacuate the building and clear the surrounding area.
And what would that have achieved?
We hoped that with the building empty, even if we'd been captured, the other agents who came over the border a day ahead of us might have a clear hour to get into the council chamber and remove the declaration.
But the Iraqis would have taken the document with them.
Not necessarily. Our plan was that we would tell them what would happen to their beloved leader if the safe was closed by anyone other than me. We felt that would cause panic and they'd probably leave everything behind.
So Kratz drew the short straw.
Yes, said Scott quietly. Not that his original plan is relevant any longer, after I was stupid enough to hand over the declaration to Hamil. So we'll now have to use the time to get out, not in.
But you didn't hand it over, said Hannah. The declaration is still on the wall of the chamber.
I'm afraid not, said Scott. Hamil was right. I switched the copies after I set the alarm off, so I ended up giving Hamil back the original.
No, you didn't, said Hannah. It's because you believed you switched the original that you fooled Hamil as well as yourself.
What are you talking about? Said Scott.
I'm the one responsible, said Hannah. I found the cardboard tube in the safe and switched the two documents, thinking I could get out of the building and then pass on a message to let Kratz know what I'd done. The trouble was you and General Hamil arrived just as I was about to leave, so when you locked yourself in the chamber, you put the original back on the wall, and then you handed over the copy to Hamil.
Scott took her in his arms again. You're a genius, he said.
No, I'm not, said Hannah. So you'd better let me in on the secret of what you've planned for this particular scenario. To start with, how do we get out of a locked safe?
That's the beauty of it, said Scott. It isn't locked. It's programmed so that it can only be opened and closed by me.
Who dreamed that one up?
A Swede who would happily take our place, but he's stuck in Kalmar. The first thing I have to do is discover which wall is the door.
That's easy, said Hannah. It has to be exactly opposite me because I'm sitting below the picture of Saddam, remember?
Scott and Hannah began the short crawl on their hands and knees to the other side of the safe. Now we go to the right-hand corner, he said, so that when we push, the leverage will be easier. Hannah nodded and then remembered they couldn't see each other.
Yes, she said.
Scott checked the luminous dial of his watch. But not quite yet, he added. We'll still have to give Kratz a little more time.
Enough time to tell me what the whopper is?
asked Hannah.
Good, said the general, when Kratz didn't react to the needle being jabbed into his big toe. Now we can find out all we need to know. But to begin with, some simple questions. Your Mossad rank?
Colonel, said Kratz.
The secret was to tell them only facts you felt confident they already knew.
Your initiation number?
78216, he said. If in doubt, assume they know. Otherwise you could be found out.
And your official position?
Counselor for Cultural Affairs to the Court of St. James in London. You are allowed 3 testing lies and 1 whopper, but no more.
What are the names of your 3 colleagues who accompanied you on this mission?
Professor Scott Bradley, an expert on ancient manuscripts. The first testing lie. Ben Cohen and Aziz Zibari. The truth.
And the girl, Hannah Kopek, what is her rank in Mossad?
She is still a trainee.
How long has she been with Mossad?
Just over 2 years.
And her role?
To be placed in Baghdad to discover where the Declaration of Independence was located. The second lie.
You are doing well, Colonel, said the general,
looking at the long, thin cardboard tube he held in his right hand.
And was this your overall responsibility as her commanding officer?
No. I was simply to accompany the safe from Kalmar. The third lie.
But surely that was nothing more than an excuse to locate the Declaration of Independence.
Kratz hesitated. Experts had been able to show that even under the influence of a truth drug, a highly trained agent would still hesitate when asked a secret he had never revealed in the past.
What was the true purpose of your bringing the safe to Baghdad, Colonel?
Kratz still remained silent.
Colonel Kratz, said the general, his voice rising with every word, what was the real reason you brought this safe to Baghdad?
Kratz counted to 3 before he spoke.
To blow up the Ba'ath Party headquarters with a tiny nuclear device secreted in the safe in the hope of killing the president along with all the members of the Revolutionary Command Council.
The whopper. How Kratz wished he could see the general's face. It was Hamil who was hesitating now.
How was the bomb to be activated?
Again Kratz did not reply.
I will ask you once again, Colonel, how was the bomb to be activated?
Still Kratz said nothing.
When will it go off?
Shouted the general.
2 hours after the safe has been closed by anyone other than the professor.
The general checked his watch, rushed to the only phone in the room, and shouted to be put through to the president immediately. He waited until he heard Saddam's voice. He didn't notice that Kratz had fainted and fallen from his chair to the floor. Scott eased himself into the corner before once again checking the little sulfur dots on his watch. It was 5:19. He and Hannah had been in the safe for 1 hour and 17 minutes. I'm going to push now. If you hear anything, shove as hard as you can. If there's anyone still out there, our only hope will be to take them by surprise. Scott began to exert the minimum amount of pressure on the corner of the door with the tips of his fingers. It eased open 1 inch. He stopped and listened, but could hear nothing. He took a look through the tiny crack and could see no one. He pushed 1 inch. Still no sound. Both of them now had a clear view of the corridor. Scott looked at Hannah and nodded, and together they shoved as hard as they could. The ton of steel shot open. They both leaped into the corridor, but there was no one to be seen. There was an eerie silence. Scott and Hannah walked slowly down the short corridor, keeping to the sides until they reached the chamber. Still no sound. Scott put a foot into the chamber and glanced to his left. The Declaration of Independence was still hanging on the wall next to the portrait of Saddam. Hannah moved silently to the far end of the chamber and stared into the long corridor. She then looked back at Scott and nodded. Scott checked the spelling of British before saying a silent hallelujah. He pulled out three of the nails, then eased the declaration over the remaining nail in the top right-hand corner, trying to forget that he had spat on a national treasure and rubbed it in the dust. He gave Saddam one last look before rolling up the parchment and joining Hannah in the corridor. Hannah slid along the wall, then pointed to the elevator. She pulled a finger across her throat to show Scott she wanted to avoid using it in favor of the back stairs. He nodded his agreement and followed her out of the side door. They moved quickly but silently up the six flights of stairs until they reached the ground floor. Hannah beckoned Scott into the side room where the cleaners had collected their boxes. She had reached the window on the far side of the room and was on her knees even before Scott had closed the door. He joined her, and they stared out on a deserted Victory Square. There was no one to be seen in any direction. "God bless Kratz," said Scott. Hannah nodded and beckoned him to follow her again. She led him back into the corridor and guided him quickly to the side door. Scott opened the door tentatively and slipped out ahead of her. A moment later, she joined him on the tarmac. He pointed to a group of palm trees halfway across the courtyard, and she nodded once again. They covered the 20 yards to its relative safety in under 3 seconds. Scott turned to look back at the building and saw the truck standing up against the wall. He assumed that, in the panic, it was just something else that had been left behind. He tapped Hannah on the shoulder and indicated that he wanted to return to the building. They covered the ground at the same pace as before, ducking back inside the door. Scott led Hannah to the main corridor where they found the front door was swinging on its hinges. He looked through the gap and pointed to the truck, mimed to which side he would go, and touched her shoulder. Again they sprinted across the tarmac as if reacting to a starting pistol. Scott jumped behind the wheel as Hannah leaped in the other side. "Where the hell?" was Scott's first reaction when he discovered the ignition key wasn't in place. They began frantically to search the glove compartment under the seats on the dashboard. "The bastards must have taken the key with them." "Simon, look out!" screamed Hannah. Scott turned to see a figure leaping up onto the running board. Hannah moved quickly into position to attack the intruder, but Scott blocked her. "Good afternoon, miss," said the stranger. "Sorry we haven't been properly introduced," he added before turning to Scott. "Move over, Professor," he said as he put the key back in the ignition. "I'll do the driving." "What in heaven's name are you doing here, Sergeant?" asked Scott. "Now that's what I call a real American welcome," replied Cohen. "But to answer your question, I was just obeying orders. I was told if you came out of that door carrying a cardboard tube, I was to get myself back here and move the hell out of it, but not under any circumstances to allow you to make a detour to the Foreign Ministry. By the way, where's the tube?" "Look out!" shouted Hannah again as she turned and saw an Arab charging towards them from the other side. "That one won't do you any harm," said Cohen. "He's bloody useless. Doesn't even know the difference between a Diet Coke and a Pepsi." Aziz leaped onto the running board and said to Scott, "I think we've got about another 20 minutes, Professor, before they work out that there's no bomb in the safe." "Then let's get out of here," said Scott.
"But where to?" asked Hannah.
"Aziz and I have already done a reconnoiter, sir. As soon as the sirens sounded, we knew that Kratz must have sold them the whopper because they couldn't move fast enough to get themselves below. Soldiers and police first seems to be the rule out here. Aziz and I have had the run of the city center for the last hour. In fact, the only person we bumped into was one of our own agents, Dave Feldman. He'd already figured out the best route to give us a chance of avoiding any military."
"Not bad, Cohen," said Scott. Cohen turned suddenly and stared at the professor.
"I didn't do it for you. I did it for Colonel Kratz. He got me out of jail once, and he's the only officer that's ever treated me like a human being. So whatever it is that you're holding in your hands, Professor, it had bloody well better be worth his life."
"Thousands have given their lives for it over the years," said Scott quietly. "It's the American Declaration of Independence."
"Good God," said Cohen. "How did the bastards get their hands on that?" He paused briefly. "Am I meant to believe you?"
Scott nodded and unrolled the parchment. Cohen and Aziz stared in disbelief for several seconds.
Right then, we'd better get you home, Professor, hadn't we? Said Cohen. Aziz will take over while we're in his neck of the woods.
He jumped out of the cab, and the Kurd came running around to take his place behind the wheel. Once Cohen had clambered over the tailgate, he banged the roof of the truck, and Aziz switched the engine on. They accelerated around the courtyard, drove straight through the barrier, and out onto Victory Square. The only other vehicles to be seen had long since been abandoned, and there was no sign of anyone on the streets.
The area has been cleared for 3 miles in every direction, so it will be a little time before we come across anything, Aziz said as he turned left into Kindy Street.
He quickly moved the truck up to 60 miles per hour, a speed only Saddam had ever experienced before on that particular road.
I'm going to take the old Bakuba road out of the city, traveling through the areas where we're least likely to see any sign of the military, explained Aziz as he passed the fountain made famous by Ali Baba. I'm still hoping to reach the highway out of Baghdad within the magic 2 hours.
Aziz took a sudden right, switching gears, but hardly losing any speed as he continued through what gave every impression of being a ghost town. Scott looked up at the sun as they crossed a bridge over the Tigris. In an hour or so it would have disappeared behind the highest buildings, and their chances of remaining undetected would greatly improve. Aziz swung past Carmel Junblat University and into Jamila Street. There were still no people on the roads or sidewalks, and Scott felt that if anyone did see them now, they would assume they were part of an army unit on patrol. It was Hannah who spotted the first person, an old man, bent double, sitting on the edge of the sidewalk as if nothing in particular had taken place. They drove past him at 60 miles per hour, but he didn't even look up. Aziz swung into the next road and found himself facing a group of young looters carrying off televisions and electronic equipment. They scattered when they saw the truck. Around the next corner there were more looters, but still no sign of police or soldiers. When Aziz spotted the first dark green uniforms, he swerved quickly right down a side street that on any other Wednesday would have been packed with shoppers, and where a vehicle would have been lucky to average more than 5 miles per hour. But today, Aziz managed to keep the speedometer above 50. He turned right again, and they saw some of the first of the locals who had ventured back onto the streets. Once they had reached the end of the road, Aziz was able to join the main thoroughfare out of Baghdad. The traffic was still light. Aziz eased the truck across into the outside lane, checking his rearview mirror every few seconds, and complying with the speed limit of 50 miles per hour.
Never get stopped for the wrong reasons, Kratz had warned him 1,000 times.
When Aziz switched his headlights on, Scott's hopes began to rise. Although the 2 hours had to be up, he doubted that anybody would be out searching for them yet, and it was well understood that with every mile out of Baghdad, the citizens became less and less loyal to Saddam. Once Aziz had left the Baghdad boundary sign behind him, he pushed the speedometer up to 60.
Give me 20 minutes, Allah, he said. Please give me 20 minutes and I'll get them to Castle Post.
Castle Post? Said Scott. We're not on a Red Indian scouting mission. Aziz laughed.
No, Professor, it's the site of a First World War British Army post where we can hide for the night. If I can get you there before...
All three of them spotted the first army truck coming towards them. Aziz swung off to the left, skidded into a side road, and was immediately forced to drop his speed.
So now where are we heading? Asked Scott.
Khan Beni Saad, said Aziz, the village where I was born. It will only be possible for us to stay for one night, but no one will think of looking for us there. But tomorrow, Professor, you will have to decide which of the 6 borders we're going to cross.
General Hamil had been pacing around his office for the past hour. The 2 hours had long passed, and he was starting to wonder if Kratz might have got the better of him. But he couldn't work out how. He was even beginning to regret that he had killed the man. If Kratz had still been alive, at least he could have fallen back on the tried and trusted method of torture. Now he would never know how he would have responded to his particular shaving technique. Hamil had already ordered a reluctant lieutenant and his platoon back to the basement of the Ba'ath headquarters. The lieutenant had returned swiftly to report that the safe door was wide open and the truck had disappeared, as had the document that had been hanging on the wall.
The general smiled. He remained confident that he was in possession of the original declaration, but he extracted the parchment from the cylinder and laid it on his desk to double-check. When he came to the word British, he turned first white and then, by several degrees, deeper and deeper shades of red. He immediately gave an order to cancel all military leave, and next commanded 5 divisions of the elite guard to mount a search for the terrorists. But he had no way of knowing how much start they had on him, how far they might have already traveled, and in which direction. However, he did know that they couldn't remain on the main roads in that truck for long without being spotted. Once it was dark, they would probably retreat into the desert to rest overnight, but they would have to come out the following morning, when they must surely try to cross one of the 6 borders. The general had already given an order that if even one of the terrorists managed to cross any border, guards from every customs post would be arrested and jailed, whether they were on duty or not. The 2 soldiers who were supposed to have closed the safe door had already been shot for not carrying out his orders, and the major detailed to supervise the moving of the safe had immediately been arrested. At least Major Saeed's decision to take his own life had saved Hamil the trouble of a court-martial. Within an hour, the major had been found hanging in his cell. Obviously, leaving a coil of rope in the middle of the floor below a hook in the ceiling had proved to be a compelling enough hint. And as for the 2 young medical students who'd been responsible for the injections and who had witnessed his conversation with Kratz, they were already on their way to the southern borders to serve with a less-than-elite regiment. They were such nice-looking boys, the general thought. He gave them a week, at the most. Hamil picked up the phone and dialed a private number that would connect him to the palace. He needed to be certain that he was the first person to explain to the president what had taken place that afternoon. Chapter 33. Scott had always considered his own countrymen to be an hospitable race, but he had never experienced such a welcome as Aziz's family gave to the 3 strangers. Khan Beni Saad, the village in which Aziz was born, had, he told them, just over 250 inhabitants at the last count, and barely survived on the income it derived from selling its small crop of oranges, tangerines, and dates to the housewives of Kirkuk and Arbil. The chief of the tribe, who turned out to be one of Aziz's uncles, immediately opened his little stone home to them so that they could make use of the 1 bath in the village. The women of the house, there seemed to be a lot of them, kept boiling water until all of the visitors were pronounced clean. When Scott finally emerged from the chief's home, he found a table had been set up under a clump of citrus trees in the Huwaider fields. It was laden with strange fish, meat, fruit, and vegetables. He feared they must have gathered something from every home in the village. Under a clear, starlit night, they devoured the fresh food and drank mountain water that, if bottled, a Californian would happily have paid a fortune for. But Scott's thoughts kept returning to the fact that tomorrow they would have to leave these idyllic surroundings, and that he would somehow have to get them all across one of the 6 borders. After coffee had been served in various different-sized cups and mugs, the chief rose from his place at the head of the table to make a speech of welcome, which Aziz translated. Scott made a short reply, which was applauded even before Aziz had been given the chance to interpret what he had said. "That's one thing they have in common with us," said Hannah, taking Scott's hand. "They admire brevity." The chief ended the evening with an offer for which Scott thanked him but felt unable to accept. He wanted to order all of his family out of the little house so that his guests could sleep indoors. Scott continued to protest until Aziz explained, "You must agree, or you insult his home by suggesting it is not good enough for you to rest in. And it is an Arab custom that the greatest compliment you can pay your host is to make your woman pregnant while you sleep under his roof." Aziz shrugged. Scott lay awake most of the night, staring through the glassless window, while Hannah hardly stirred in his arms. Having attempted to pay the chief the greatest possible compliment, Scott's mind went back to the problem of getting his team over one of the borders and ensuring that the Declaration of Independence was returned safely to Washington. When the first ray of light crept across the woven rug that covered their bed, Scott released Hannah and kissed her on the forehead. He slipped from under the sheets to find that the little tin bath was already full of warm water, and the women had begun boiling more urns over an open fire. Once Scott was dressed, he spent an hour studying maps of the country, searching for possible routes across Iraq's six borders. He quickly dismissed Syria and Iran as impossible because the armies of both would be happy to slaughter them on sight. He also felt that to return over the Jordanian border would be far too great a risk. By the time Hannah had joined him, he had also dismissed Saudi Arabia as too well guarded, and was now down to only five routes and two borders. As his hosts began to prepare breakfast, Scott and Hannah wandered down into the village hand in hand, as any lovers might on a summer morning. The locals smiled, and some bowed. Although none could hold a conversation with them, they all spoke so eloquently with their eyes that they both understood. Once they had reached the end of the village, they turned and strolled back up the path towards the chief's house to find Cone frying eggs on an open fire. Hannah stopped to watch how the women baked the thin, circular pieces of bread which, covered in honey, were a feast in themselves. The chief, once again sitting at the head of the table, beckoned Scott to the place beside him. Cohen had already taken a seat on a stool and was about to begin his breakfast when a goat walked in and tugged the eggs straight off the plate. Hannah laughed and cracked Cohen another egg before he had a chance to voice his opinion. Scott spread some honey on a piece of warm bread, and a woman placed a mug of goat's milk in front of him. "Worked out what we have to do next, have you, Professor?" asked Cohen as Hannah dropped a second fried egg onto his plate. In one sentence he had brought them all back to reality. A villager ran up to the table, knelt by the side of the chief, and whispered in his ear. The message was passed on to Aziz. "Bad news," Aziz told them. "There are soldiers blocking all the roads that lead back to the main highway." "Then we'll have to go across the desert," said Scott. He unfolded his map and spread it across the table. Alternative routes were highlighted by a dozen blue felt-tipped lines. He pointed to a path leading to a road which would take them to the city of Kalis. "That is not a path," said Aziz. "It was once a river, but it dried up many years ago. We could walk along it, but we would have to leave the truck behind." "It won't be enough to leave the truck," said Scott. "We'll have to destroy it. If it were ever found by Saddam's soldiers, they would raze the village to the ground and massacre your people." The chief looked perplexed as Aziz translated all Scott had said. The old man stroked the rough morning stubble on his chin and smiled as Scott and Hannah listened to his judgment, unable to understand a word. "My uncle says you must have his car," Aziz translated. "It is old, but he hopes that it still runs well." "He is kind," said Scott, "but if we cannot drive a truck across the desert, how can we possibly go by car?"
"He understands your problem," said Aziz. "He says you must take the car to pieces, bit by bit, and his people will carry it the 12 miles across the desert until you reach the road that leads to Kalis. Then you can put it together again."
"We cannot accept such a gesture," said Scott. "He's too generous. We'll walk and find some form of transport when we reach Huwaider." He pointed to the first village along the road. Aziz translated once again. His uncle looked sad and murmured a few words.
"He says it is not really his car. It was his brother's car. It now belongs to me."
For the first time, Scott realized that Aziz's father had been the village chief, and how much his uncle was willing to risk to save them from being captured by Saddam's troops. "But even if we could take the car to pieces and put it together again, what about army patrols once we reach that road?" he asked. "By now thousands of Hamil's men are bound to be out there searching for us."
"But not on those roads," Aziz replied. "The army will stick to the highway. They realize that's our only hope of getting across the border. No, our first problem will come when we reach the roadside check at Kalis."
He moved his finger a few inches across the map. There's bound to be at least a couple of soldiers on duty there.
Scott studied the different routes again while Aziz listened to his uncle.
And could we get as far as Tuz Kurmatu without having to use the highway?
Asked Scott, not looking up from the map.
Yes, there's a longer route through the hills that the army would never consider because they'd run the risk of being attacked by the Peshmerga guerrillas so near the border with Kurdistan. But once you've gone through Tuz Kurmatu, it's only a couple of miles to the main highway, though it's still another 45 miles from there with no other way of crossing the border.
Scott held his head in his hands and didn't speak for some moments.
So, if we took that route, we would be committed to crossing the border at Kirkuk, he eventually said, where both sides could prove to be unfriendly.
The chief started tapping Kirkuk on the map with his finger while talking urgently to his nephew.
My uncle says Kirkuk is our best chance. Most of the inhabitants are Kurdish and hate Saddam Hussein. Even the Iraqi soldiers have been known to defect and become Kurdish Peshmergas.
But how will they know which side we're on? Asked Scott.
My uncle will get a message to the Peshmergas so that when you reach the border, they will do everything they can to help you to cross it. It's not an official border, but once you're in Kurdistan, you'll be safe.
The Kurds sound like our best bet, said Hannah, who had been listening intently, especially if they believe our original mission was to kill Saddam.
It might just work, sir, said Cohen. That is, if the car's up to it.
You're the mechanic, Cole, so only you can tell us if it's possible. Once Aziz had translated Scott's words, the chief rose to his feet and led them to the back of the house. He came to a halt beside a large, oblong object covered by a black sheet. He and Aziz lifted off the cover. Scott couldn't believe his eyes.
A pink caddy? He said. A classic 1955 Sedan de Ville, to be exact, sir, said Cohen, rubbing his hands with delight.
He opened the long, heavy door and climbed behind the vast steering wheel. He pulled a lever under the dashboard and the hood flicked up. He got out, lifted the hood, and studied the engine for some minutes.
Not bad, he said. If I can nick a few parts from the truck, I'll give you a racing car within a couple of hours.
Scott checked his watch. I can only spare you an hour if we're hoping to cross the border tonight. Scott and Hannah returned to the house and once again pored over the map. The road Aziz had recommended was roughly 12 miles away, but across terrain that would be hard going even if they were carrying nothing.
It could take hours, Scott said.
What's the alternative if we can't use the highway? Asked Hannah.
While she and Scott continued working on the route and Cohen on the car, Aziz rounded up 30 of the strongest men in the village. At a few minutes past the hour, Cohen reappeared in the house, his hands, arms, face, and hair covered in oil.
It's ready to be taken apart, Professor.
Well done, but we'll have to get rid of the truck first, said Scott as he rose from the table.
That won't be possible, sir, said Cohen, now that I've removed one or two of the best parts of its engine. That Cadillac should be able to do over 100 miles per hour, he said, with some pride, in third gear.
Scott laughed, and accompanied by Aziz, went in search of the chief. Once again he explained the problem. This time the chief's face showed no anxiety. Aziz translated his thoughts.
Do not fear, my friend, he says. While you are marching across the desert, we will strip the truck and bury each piece in a place Saddam's soldiers could never hope to discover in 1,000 years.
Scott looked apprehensive, but Aziz nodded his agreement. Without waiting for Scott's opinion, the chief led his nephew to the back of the house, where they found Cohen supervising the stripping of the Cadillac and the distribution of its pieces among the chosen 30. 4 men were to carry the engine on a makeshift stretcher, and another 6 would lift the chrome body onto their shoulders like pallbearers. 4 more each carried a wheel with its white-rimmed tire, while another 4 transported the chassis. 2 held onto the red and white leather front seat, another 2 the back seat, and 1 the dashboard.
Cohen continued to distribute the remaining pieces of the Cadillac until he came to the back of the line, where three children who looked no more than 10 or 11 were given responsibility for 2 5-gallon cans of gas and a tool bag. Only the roof was to be discarded. Aziz's uncle led his people to the last house in the village so he could watch his guests begin their journey towards the horizon. Scott shook hands with the chief, but could find no words adequate to thank him. "Give me a call the next time you're passing through New Haven," was what he would have said to a fellow American. "I will return in better times," he told the old man. And Aziz translated. "My people wait for that day." Scott turned to watch Cohen, compass in hand, leading his improbable platoon on what appeared likely to be an endless journey. He took one of the 5-gallon cans from the smallest of the children and pointed back towards the village, but the little boy shook his head and quickly grabbed Scott's canvas bag. Would history ever reveal this particular mode of transport for the Declaration of Independence? Scott wondered, as Cohen shouted, "Forward!" General Hamil continued to pace around his office as he waited for the phone to ring. When Saddam had learned the news of Major Saeed's incompetence in allowing the terrorists to escape with the declaration, he was only furious that he had not been able personally to end the man's life. The only order he had given the general was that a message should be put out on state radio and television stations hourly, stating that there had been an attempt on his life which had failed, but that the Zionist terrorists were still at large. Full descriptions of the would-be assassins were given, and he asked his beloved countrymen to help him in his quest to hunt down the infidels. Had the matter been less urgent, the general would have counseled against releasing such information on the grounds that most of those who came across the terrorists might want to help them, or at best turn a blind eye. The only advice he did give his leader was to suggest that a large reward should be offered for their capture. Enlightened self-interest, he had found, could so often overcome almost any scruples. The general came to a halt in front of a map pinned to the wall behind his desk, temporarily covering a portrait of Saddam. His eye passed down the many thin red lines that wriggled between Baghdad and Iraq's borders. There were 100 villages on both sides of every one of the roads, and the general was painfully aware that most of them would be only too happy to harbor the fugitives. And then he recalled one of the names Kratz had given him. Aziz Zibari, a common enough name, yet it had been nagging at him the whole morning. Aziz Zibari. Aziz Zibari. Aziz Zibari. He repeated. And then he remembered. He had executed a man of that name who had been involved in an attempted coup against Saddam about 7 years before. Could it possibly have been the traitor's father?
Honor Among Thieves, Cassette 9.
The load-bearers halted every 15 minutes to rest, change responsibilities, and place the strain on yet untested muscles. Pit stops, Cohen called them. They managed 2 miles in the first hour, and between them drank far more water than any car would have devoured. When Scott checked his watch at midday, he estimated that they had only covered a little over 2/3 of the distance to the road. It had been a long time since they had lost sight of the village, and there was still no sign of life on the horizon. The sun beat down as they continued their journey, the pace slowing with each mile. It was the eyes of a 10-year-old child that were the first to see any movement. He ran to the front and pointed. Scott could see nothing as the little boy jogged ahead, and it was to be another 40 minutes before they could all clearly see the dusty road. The sight made them quicken their pace. Once they reached the side of the road, Aziz gave the order that the pieces of the car should be lowered gently to the ground, and a little girl, who Scott hadn't noticed before, handed out bread, goat's cheese, and water while they rested. Cohen was the first up and began walking around his platoon, checking on the various pieces. By the time he had returned to the chassis, they were all impatient to put the car together again. Scott sat on the ground and watched as 30 untrained mechanics, under the direction of Sergeant Cohn, slowly bolted the old Cadillac together piece by piece. When the last wheel had been screwed on, Scott had to admit it looked like a car, but wondered if the old veteran would ever be able to start. All the villagers surrounded the massive pink vehicle as Cohn sat in the driver's seat. Aziz waited until the children had emptied their last drop of gas into the tank. He then screwed on the big steel cap and shouted, "Go for it!" Cohen turned the key in the ignition. The engine turned over slowly but wouldn't catch. Cohen leaped out, lifted the hood, and asked Aziz to take his place behind the wheel. He made a slight readjustment to the fan belt, checked the distributor, and cleaned the spark plugs of the last few remaining grains of sand before screwing them in tightly. He stuck his head out from under the hood. "Have a go, Kurd." Aziz turned the key and pressed the accelerator. The engine turned over a little more quickly, but still didn't want to start. 60 eyes stared beneath the hood, but offered no advice, as Cohen spent several more minutes working on the distributor head. "Once again, and give it more throttle," he shouted. Aziz switched on the ignition. The chug became a churn and then suddenly a roar as Aziz pressed the accelerator, a noise only exceeded by the cheers of the villagers. Cohen took Aziz's place in the front and lifted the gear shift on the steering column up into first. But the car refused to budge as the wheels spun around and it bedded itself deeper and deeper into the sand. Cohen turned off the engine and jumped out. 60 hands were flattened against the body as it was rocked back and forth, and then, with one great shove, it was eased out of its deep trough. The villagers pushed it a further 20 yards and then waited for the sergeant's next order. Cohen pointed to the little girl who had distributed the food. She came shyly forward, and he lifted her into the front of the car. With sign language, Cohen instructed her to kneel by the accelerator pedal and press down. Without getting into the car, Cohen leaned across, checked that the gears were in neutral, and switched on the engine. The little girl continued to push down on the accelerator with both hands, and the engine revved into action. She immediately burst into tears as the villagers cheered even louder. Cohen quickly lifted the little girl out onto the sand and then beckoned to Aziz. "You're about half my weight, mate, so get in, put it into first gear, and see if you can keep it going for about 100 yards. If you can, we'll all jump in. If you can't, we'll have to push the bloody thing all the way to the border." Aziz stepped gingerly into the Cadillac. Sitting on the edge of the leather seat, he gently lifted the lever into first gear and pressed down on the accelerator. The car inched forward, and the villagers began to cheer again as Scott, Hannah, and Cohen ran along beside it. Hannah opened the passenger door, pushed the seat forward, and jumped into the back as the car continued at its slow pace. Cohen leaped in after her and shouted, "Second gear!" Aziz pulled the lever down, across, and up. The car lurched forward. "That's third, you stupid Kurd!" shouted Cohen. He turned to see Scott running almost flat out. Cohen reached across to hold the door open as Scott threw his bag into the back. Scott leaped in, and Cohen grabbed him around the shoulders. Scott's head landed in Aziz's lap, but although the Kurd swerved, the car still kept going on the firmer sand. Aziz continued swinging the car from side to side to avoid the mounds of sand that had blown onto the road. "I can see why there aren't likely to be any army patrols on this road," was Cohen's only comment. Scott turned back to see the villagers waving frantically. Returning their waves seemed inadequate after all they had done. He hadn't thanked them properly or even said goodbye. The villagers didn't move until the car was out of sight. General Hamil swung around, angry that anyone had dared to enter his office without knocking. His ADC came to a halt in front of his desk. He was shaking, only too aware of the mistake he had made. The general raised his swagger stick and was about to strike the young officer across the face when he bleated out, "We've discovered the village that the traitor Aziz Zibari comes from, General." Amir lowered his arm slowly until the swagger stick came to rest on the officer's right shoulder. The tip pushed forward until it was about an inch away from the ball of his right eye.
Where? Khan Beni Saad, said the young man in terror. Show me.
The lieutenant ran over to the map, studied it for a few moments, and then placed a finger on a village about 10 miles north of Baghdad. General Hamil stared at the spot and smiled for the first time that day. He returned to his desk, picked up the phone, and barked out an order. Within an hour, hundreds of troops would be swarming all over the little village. Even if Khan Beni Saad did only have a population of 250, the general felt confident someone would talk, however young. Aziz was able to keep up a steady 30 miles per hour while Scott tried to work out where they were on the map. He couldn't pinpoint their exact location until they had been driving for nearly an hour, when they came across a crude, hand-painted signpost lying in the road that read, Khalis, 25 kilometers. Keep going for now, said Scott, but we'll have to stop a couple of miles outside town so I can figure out how we get past the checkpoint. Scott's confidence in the old chief's judgment that there would be no army vehicles on that road was growing with every mile of flat desert road they covered. He continued to study the map carefully, now certain of the route that would have to be taken if they still hoped to cross the border that day. So what do we do when we reach the checkpoint? Asked Cohn. Maybe it'll be easier than we think, said Scott. Don't forget they're looking for 4 people in a massive army truck. But we are 4 people. We won't be by the time we reach the checkpoint, explained Scott, because by then you and I will be in the trunk. Cohen scowled. Just be thankful it's a caddy, said Aziz, grinning as he tried to maintain the steady speed.
Perhaps I should take over the wheel now, said Cohen.
Not here, said Scott. While we're on these roads, Aziz stays put. It was Hannah who saw her first.
What the hell does she think she's up to? She said, pointing to a woman who had jumped out into the middle of the road and was waving her arms excitedly.
Scott gripped the side of the window ledge as Cohen leaned forward to get a clearer view. Don't stop, said Scott. Swerve around her if you have to. Suddenly, Aziz began laughing.
What's so funny, Curd? Asked Cohen, keeping his eyes fixed on the woman, who remained determinedly in the middle of the road.
It's only my cousin, Jasmine.
Another cousin? Said Hannah.
We are all cousins in my tribe, Aziz explained as he brought the Cadillac to a halt in front of her.
He leaped out of the car and threw his arms around the young woman as the others joined them.
Not bad, said Cohen when he was finally introduced to Cousin Jasmine, who hadn't stopped talking even when she shook hands with Scott and Hannah. So what's she jabbering on about then? Demanded Cohen, before Aziz had been given the chance to translate his cousin's words.
It seems the professor was right. The soldiers have been warned to look out for an army truck being driven by 4 terrorists. But her uncle had already been in touch this morning to warn her we'd be in the Cadillac.
Then it must be a hell of a risk to try and get past them, said Hannah.
A risk, agreed Aziz, but not a hell of a risk. Jasmine crosses this checkpoint twice a day, every day, to sell oranges, tangerines, and dates from our village. So she's well known to them, and so is my uncle's car. My uncle says she must be in the Cadillac when we go through the checkpoint. That way they won't be suspicious.
But if they decide to search the trunk?
Then they won't get their daily ration of cigarettes or fruit for their families, will they? You see, they all take it for granted we must be smuggling something.
Jasmine started chattering again, and Aziz listened dutifully.
She says you must all climb into the trunk before someone passing spots us.
It's still a hell of a risk, Professor, said Cohen.
It's just as big a risk for Jasmine, said Scott, and I don't see any other route. He folded up the map, walked around to the back of the car, opened the trunk, and climbed in. Hannah and Cohen followed without another word.
Not as comfortable as the safe,
remarked Hannah as she put her arms around Scott. Aziz wedged the bag between her and Cohen. Hannah laughed.
One bang on the side of the door, said Aziz, and I'll be stopping at the checkpoint.
He slammed down the trunk. Jasmine grabbed her bags from the side of the road and jumped in next to her cousin. The 3 of them in the trunk heard the engine splutter into action and begin its more stately progress over the last few miles towards Khalis. Jasmine used the time to brief Aziz on her routine whenever she crossed the checkpoint.
Chapter 34. The chief was hanged first. Then his brothers, one by one, in front of the rest of the village. But none of them uttered a word. Then they moved on to his cousins, until a 12-year-old girl who hoped to save her father's life told them about the strangers who had stayed in the chief's house the previous night. They promised the little girl that her father would be saved if she told them everything she knew. She pointed out into the desert to show them where they had buried the truck. 20 minutes of digging by the soldiers, and they were able to confirm that she was telling the truth. They contacted General Hamil by field phone. He found it hard to believe that 30 of the Zibari tribe had taken the chief's Cadillac to pieces and carried it bit by bit across the open desert. "Oh, yes," the little girl assured them. "I know it's true because my brother carried one of the wheels all the way to the road on the other side of the desert," she declared, pointing proudly towards the horizon. General Hamil listened carefully to the information over the phone before ordering that the girl's father and brother should also be hanged. He returned to the map on the wall and quickly pinpointed the only possible road they could have taken. His eye moved along the path across a stretch of desert until it joined another winding road, and then he realized which town they would have to pass through. He looked at the clock on his desk, 4:39. "Get me the checkpoint at Kalis," he instructed the young lieutenant. Aziz saw a stationary van in the distance being inspected by a soldier. Jasmine warned him it was the checkpoint and tipped out the contents of one of her bags onto the seat between them. Aziz banged on the side of his door, relieved to see there were only two soldiers in sight and that one of them was sleeping in a comfortable old chair on the other side of the road. When the car came to a halt, Scott could hear laughter coming from somewhere. Aziz passed a pack of Rothmans to the guard. The soldier was just about to wave them through when the other guard stirred from his drowsy slumber like a cat who had been resting for hours on a radiator. He pushed himself up, moved slowly towards the car, and looked over it with admiration, as he had done many times before. He began to stroll around it. As he passed the trunk, he gave it a loving slap with the palm of his hand. It flicked open a few inches. Scott pulled it gently closed as Jasmine dropped a carton of 200 Rothmans on the ground by her side of the car. The border guard moved quickly for the first time that day. Jasmine gave him a smile as he retrieved the cigarettes and whispered something in his ear. The soldier looked at Aziz and started laughing as a large truck stacked with crates of beer came to a halt behind them. "Move on, move on," shouted the first soldier as the sight of greater rewards caught his eye. Aziz quickly obeyed and lurched forward in second gear, nearly throwing Cohen and the hold-all out of the back. "What did you say to that soldier?" asked Aziz once they were out of earshot. "I told him you were gay, but I would be returning on my own later." "Have you no family pride?" asked Aziz. "Certainly," said Jasmine, "but he is also a cousin." On Jasmine's advice, Aziz took the longer southern route around the town. He was unable to avoid all the potholes, and from time to time he heard groans coming from the trunk. Jasmine pointed to a junction ahead of them and told Aziz that that was where he should stop. She gathered up her bags, leaving some fruit on the seat between them. Aziz came to a halt by a road that led back into the center of the town. Jasmine jumped out, smiled, and waved. Aziz waved back and wondered when he would see his cousin again. He drove on alone to the far side of the town, still unable to risk letting his colleagues out of the trunk while the few locals around could observe what was going on. Once Kalis was a couple of miles behind him, Aziz came to a halt at a crossroads, which displayed two signposts. One read Tuz Kurmatu, 120 kilometers, and the other Tuz Kurmatu, 170 kilometers. He checked in every direction before climbing out of the car, opening the trunk and letting the three baggage passengers tumble out onto the road. While they stretched their limbs and took deep breaths of air, Aziz pointed to the signposts. Scott didn't need to look at the map to decide which road they would have to take. "We must take the longer route," he said, "and hope that they still think we're in the truck." Hannah slammed down the trunk with feeling before they all four jumped back into the car. Aziz averaged 40 miles an hour on the winding road, his three passengers ducking out of sight whenever another vehicle appeared on the horizon. The four of them devoured the fresh fruit Jasmine had left on the front seat. When they passed a signpost indicating 20 kilometers to Tuzkurmatu, Scott said to Aziz, "I want you to stop a little way outside the village and go in alone before we decide if it's safe for us to drive straight through. Don't forget it's only another 3 miles beyond Tuzkurmatu to the highway, so the place could be swarming with soldiers."
"And to the Kurdish border?" asked Hannah.
"About 45 miles, said Scott, as he continued to study the map. Aziz drove for another 20 minutes before he came over the brow of a hill and could see the outline of a village nestling in the valley. A few moments later he pulled the car off the road and parked it under a row of citrus trees that sheltered them from the sun and the prying eyes of those in passing vehicles. Aziz listened carefully to Scott's instructions, got out of the car, and jogged off in the direction of Tuzkurmatu. General Hamil was too furious to speak when the young lieutenant informed him that the Cadillac had passed through the Kali's checkpoint less than an hour before, and neither of the soldiers on duty had bothered to check the trunk. After a minimum of torture, one of them had confessed that the terrorists must have been helped by a young girl who regularly passed through the checkpoint. "She will never pass through it again," had been the general's one observation. The only other piece of information they were able to get out of the soldiers was that whoever had been driving the car was the girl's cousin, and a homosexual. Hamil wondered how they could possibly know that. Once again, the general returned to the map on the wall behind his desk. He had already given orders for an army of helicopters, trucks, tanks, and motorcycles to cover every inch of the road between Kalis and the border. But still, no one had reported seeing a Cadillac on the highway. He was mystified, knowing they couldn't possibly have turned back or they would have run straight into his troops. His eyes searched every route between the checkpoint and the border yet again. "Ah," he said finally, "they must have taken their road through the hills." The general ran his finger along a thin, winding red line until it joined the main highway. "So that's where you are," he said, before bellowing out some new orders. It was almost an hour before Cohen announced, "One Kurd heading towards us, sir." As Aziz came running up the slope, the grin remained on his face. He had been into Tuzkurmatu, and he was able to reassure them that the village was going about its business as usual. But the government radio was blasting out a warning to be on the lookout for 4 terrorists who had attempted to assassinate the great leader. So all the main roads were now crawling with soldiers. "They've got good descriptions of all 4 of us, but the radio bulletin an hour ago was still saying we were in the truck." "Right, Aziz," said Scott. "Drive us through the village. Hannah, sit in the front with Aziz. The sergeant and I will lie down in the back. Once we're on the other side of Tuz, we'll keep out of sight and only continue on to the border after it's dark." Aziz took his place behind the wheel, and the Cadillac began its slow journey into Tuz. The main road through the village must have been about 300 yards long and just about wide enough to take 2 cars. Hannah looked at the little timber shops and the men who were growing old sitting on steps and leaning against walls. A dirty old Cadillac traveling slowly through the village, she thought, would probably be the highlight of their day. Until she saw the vehicle at the other end of the road. "There's a jeep coming towards us," she said calmly. 4 men, one of them sitting behind what looks like an anti-aircraft gun mounted on the back. "Just keep driving slowly, Aziz," said Scott. "And Hannah, keep talking us through it." "They're about 100 yards away from us now and beginning to take an interest." Cohen pointed to the tool bag and